listening to The Jackie Daily Show. Find me at JackieDaily.com, on Twitter at JackieDailyHost. On the line, I have my friend Brigham McCown. Brigham is my go-to man for all things, you know, transportation, particularly hazardous materials like East Palestine stuff. He is the former, he's going to correct me here, acting administrator, I think it was, over at the Pipelines and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration. And then, of course, now senior fellow and director of the Initiative on American Energy Security at Hudson Institute. 3 decades of experience, just left as CEO up in Alaska, Trans-Alaska Pipeline System, like the big one. There's not much Brigham hasn't done. He knows it all. He's my number one on these issues. Brigham, welcome back.
Oh, Jackie, thanks for having me back on the show. But the one thing I'm really, really proud about is my former naval service. We got to throw that in there.
Yes. I have to call you. I have to call you a fighter pilot, right? And that would be accurate, right?
Well,
you're an aviator.
Naval aviator works just fine. Naval officer, naval aviator. How's
okay.
that?
Well, I mean, it's a very sexy thing now with the new Maverick film that came out. Or I guess it's not as new right this second, but everybody raving about that film now for as long as it came out. I loved Top Gun back in the day. And that's back in the day. Well, you're a little younger than that, I think. But
it inspired me as well, right?
Yeah.
I was in college when it first came out. But you're right. The camera angles, the cinematography of the new movie really helps show the environmental forces, the G-forces that you're under flying a high-performance aircraft. I thought it was pretty good.
If I were permitted to say badass on the radio, I'd call you a badass. Jeffy, bleep that out, please. Do I get fined for that? I love that. You're right. I absolutely will not leave that out of your bio going forward. I'm writing it down right now. Love you.
Yeah.
Love you. Okay. Great American and patriot. So I know that you are paying attention to this effort to ban natural gas in this country, which is by far the cheapest in-home heating fuel by a factor of about 3 or 4. So it's what America runs on, particularly if you're low income. But the billionaires are trying to ban natural gas in our homes. Let's start with, why are they doing this? What do they get out of this?
Yeah, well, of course, Jackie, they'll tell you they're not. No. We're just increasing energy efficiency standards. We're not trying to take your gas stove. We're not trying to take your natural gas for heating. No. It just so happens that by regulating these efficiency standards, nothing that's currently made of natural gas passes the new standards, right? How convenient.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, and they're claiming that this is all about the climate, right? This is for all of us. This is going to help us survive the climate disaster. And that's why this is so daggone important, even though the handful of people who are funding this with hundreds of millions of dollars every year use about, I don't know, Bloomberg, 670 times more oil just in his jets, his 5 jets, than the average American. Okay, but the hypocrisy might be a chasing a rabbit track, but it's just good to point it out once in a while. These are the people telling us what to do.
Well, I mean, don't you have a jet? I mean, I have several, right?
Right.
Now, I don't have a jet. I don't at all. You know what? What is interesting about this whole energy debate is that energy ought to be a topic that all Americans agree with.
Right.
You know,
right.
For our economic well-being, I dare say prosperity, for our energy security, which translates to national security, for our ability to be competitive in world markets, we have to use energy – that is available, resilient, affordable, reliable. Because why? Because it makes everything go. It makes everything we use and make work. And instead, would you ever, would any government or any household ever say, we're going to start on a journey. I can't tell you how much it's going to cost. I can't tell you how long it'll take to get there. But I can tell you we're going to spend a lot more money than we would otherwise spend. And I don't even know if we can get there, but let's just go ahead and get started. That's really what we're talking about with this open-ended commitment of this war on fossil fuels. And the Biden administration's been at it pretty much since day one, which I do have to give them an A-plus in transparency. They said they were going to do it, and everybody said, oh, really? Probably not. And they're doing it.
One promise made and one promise kept, finally. One thing that I loved about your piece in, let's see, was that The Hill? Yeah. It's called Slow and Steady Wins the Climate Race. And going back to the point you just made, basically, this is about where we stand in the world. I loved that you pointed out, and you're talking now about oil, I think more than gas, of course, but in World War I, 80% of Allied fuel consumption came from the United States. And in World War II, the U.S. supplied 6 out of every 7 barrels of oil consumed by the Allied powers. And that means energy abundance equals winning world wars. I swear the purpose of this show is to prevent World War III. That's what I said years ago, because energy scarcity is a weapon of war. It will cause a war if we don't have enough. And you're one of the few people to point this out. And you say the same is now true for Europe's latest war. In other words, more than 100 years after the First World War, this has not changed. Despite the green agenda, this has not changed, right?
Yeah, it hasn't changed. And, you know, the fact that we're pursuing, or this administration is pursuing, the same energy policies that caught Europe with its, can I say this, proverbial pants down.
Oh, we're fine again.
Russian invasion is just shocking to me. If we've learned nothing over the last 14, 15 months now, the energy is a weapon. You cannot depend on others for it. You must have a domestic capability to produce it. Remember when, you know, well, maybe a lot of people don't remember. It depends on your age that you're listening. But as a kid, I remember the Arab oil embargo because of our support for Israel. The beginnings of what would become OPEC cut us off. And we were left to purchase $10, no more than gas, depending on whether your license plate was even or odd. You couldn't even get gas on some days. And every presidential administration since, Democrats and Republicans, have said we have to become energy independent. And we got there.
Yeah.
And then we've been backsliding ever since, this administration. Even President Obama said, I believe in an all-the-above approach to energy. We need it all, renewables, fossil fuels. I mean, could you imagine if that were said today? I think the left would go berserk.
Lose their minds. And yeah, so that's right. Every president tries to promise this. It is within our reach, and we know it. And maybe this is why it is our enemies, not just the billionaires, but our adversaries who are funding a lot of the green movement. I just ran across a blurb where Wheeler, back when he was a cabinet member under Trump, was saying, people, open your eyes. Our foreign adversaries are funding the green movement to undercut our energy independence. That way we can't be that source of energy in the next world war. I think that's what this is really about. And also there were congressional hearings that went into this. And people act like they've never heard this before and it's never occurred to them. But this is what happens when you unnecessarily neuter yourself from having all of the energy sources at your disposal, the U.S. being the top exporter of natural gas and also massive consumer. I have to go to a break, but when we come back, I'll continue this conversation with Brigham McCown. As I said, he used to be the top guy over at the PHMSA. That's the Pipelines and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration. Now a senior fellow at Hudson Institute, director of the Initiative on American Energy, also at NUVO. We'll take a break. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Jackie Daly Show, and I'm back with my friend Brigham McCown. And he is the former acting administrator over at the PHMSA, Pipelines and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration, and also a senior fellow over at Hudson Institute. Brigham, we were talking about the natural gas bans going on around the country. And what just happened, and a potential blow to the efforts to prevent cities from using natural gas, a federal appeals court overturned Berkeley, California's ban on natural gas hookups to new buildings. And what Berkeley was doing is meant to be a model policy for other cities. So very interesting. This is over in very liberal California. We're talking about this court. And you point out that copycat ordinances, which is exactly what they intend, in several states have attempted to emulate Berkeley and now face an uncertain future because of this decision. So the first issue is people are a little confused about, wait a second, how does a city all by itself set national policy by going up before a court? Because the court could have gone the other way, right? And the court here, we have one court deciding what might or might not be possible across the country. Explain how just that little microcosm can have such a big impact.
Yeah, sure can. I mean, a lot of these, you'll see small towns. Remember back in the 70s and 80s, towns declared they were nuclear-free zones, and nobody really paid attention. They were just sort of making statement. But Berkeley thought they were cunning, and that's actually what undid them. But they said, you know what? We probably can't actually ban natural gas because it's federally regulated. It's an interstate thing, you know. It's a national thing. So what can we do? And they came up with the brilliant idea of changing the local building code just to say, when you build a new building, you can't put gas lines into the building any longer. And then, voila, there's no natural gas. And even the most liberal federal court of appeals in the country, I would never have said, oh, I'm sure the Ninth Circuit sitting in San Francisco will get this one right, came out and said, y'all are crazy. You can't do that. It doesn't pass the straight face test to say you're not trying to regulate natural gas, because you are. And it's preempted, which is this notion that states and local governments can't do things that the federal government does. And it was tossed, unceremoniously tossed by the most liberal appeals court in the country.
That is such delicious poetic justice. I don't know how much money went into making all of that happen, but I'm sure it was teed up expecting exactly the opposite result, or either expecting no challenge and just copycats going off all over the place, which is what happens sometimes, or that they would be protected in that jurisdiction. But that's not how it happened. So
yeah, and it's interesting. It was the restaurant association that went after them. And Jackie, I have to tell you this, because I teach classes at a university that I'm not going to mention the name of today, because for this very reason. We were talking in my class about regulations, and I just kind of threw out there, hey, what do you think about this natural gas ban? And let's be honest, a lot of the kids these days, and I was probably one once too, tend to be a little more liberal. The first person looks at me and says, well, that's dumb. I said, well, why? They said, well, because cooking with natural gas is just better. And somebody else said, yeah, have you ever tried cooking? You can control the heat much better. Another person chimes in and goes, you know, food tastes better in cast iron, and cast iron gets ruined on electric stovetops. And then somebody said, tell me one celebrity you've seen on TV cooking with electric. They don't exist. And I sat there with amazement in this class, that I would not necessarily say anyone is going to sign up for. You would consider themselves a strong Trump supporter. And I thought, okay, you know, this is an issue that almost every American gets.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's such a relief to hear the young people being too smart for this kind of stuff. It really is. You feel like they just swallow whatever's on the news, but they don't. And so... And now, these are undergrads?
These are undergrads. Okay. And to your point, what I find is sometimes there are preconceived notions, but oftentimes it's because they've heard one side of the story. They lack all the facts. And when presented in a non-confrontational way with all the true facts, most of the time they get it right. So right. I think there's hope.
Yeah, for sure. Well, and I don't know if you saw... not too long ago, I saw a commentary by Robert Bryce where he was commenting on this study that came out saying supposedly children are 42% more likely to have childhood asthma if they're exposed to natural gas in the household. And so I love Robert Bryce. He's very good about really digging in to figure out, okay, what are we talking about here? And it turns out... that there was this group lavishly funded, again, by these four billionaires who are known to get involved in this gas ban thing, which is Steve Jobs' widow, Bloomberg, John Doerr, and Jeff Bezos in particular. And when he actually dug into it, he found this amazing study from, let's see, it was 2013, where, in fact, they found zero correlation. They looked at 500,000 kids across 47 countries and found no correlation between the use of natural gas and asthma. And so that was from 2013 in Lancet. And so the group that put this out walked back their claim like a day or two after releasing the study and said, oh, wait, a Washington Examiner, our study, quote, does not assume or estimate a causal relationship between childhood asthma and natural gas stoves, even though it said, quote, the natural gas stoves are linked to respiratory illness, and then gave the 42% more likely to have asthma's so-called fact. And that is what takes off in the press, Brigham, and it never gets corrected. It doesn't matter that the group that released this walked it back like 2 days later. They just keep saying it as if it's fact. And that's what your kids are going to hear and believe.
Yeah. And, you know, look, there are, it wasn't too long ago, and natural gas was seen as a legitimate bridge fuel to the future by these very same environmental groups that have now decided it is public enemy number two, right behind oil.
Oh, wait, where's coal? Where's coal?
Oh, I'm sorry. All right, we're going to have to add another one in there. Maybe this is three now. But and, you know, it is difficult to understand these particular views. I'm an all-the-above person. I don't mind renewables. I don't mind a lower carbon fuel source when it's available. You know, and this electrification drive by the Biden administration is simply not going to work, because not only do our transmission and distribution lines not capable of handling plug-ins of electric cars everywhere, i.e. see California last summer for brownouts, but we don't have the electricity generation capacity either to fully electrify the country. So without spending trillions upon trillions of dollars. And so establishing these artificial deadlines that have just been pulled out of the thin air is just, it doesn't make for good policy. It really doesn't. Under any administration, I don't care what your viewpoints are, at least articulate a coherent strategy for why you want to do what you want to do versus we just have to do this.
Well, particularly when, if you're opposed to coal, oil, natural gas, and nuclear, which most of these groups are, wow, that's about 96% or at least 90% of the energy in this country. What are they going to run us on? Can we? Okay, here's the last question, Brigham. I've got 1 minute.
Okay.
Can we fight a world war on wind, solar, and electric vehicles? For electricity for transportation. Can we win a war, a world war?
No.
Okay. I mean, I think this is the whole point for the people overseas who are pushing this. They want to neuter America. Like, they're afraid of us. They don't like the American century. They want to stop what they see as imperialism. What better way than pulling away the one thing that we had to contribute to the outcome of the last two world wars, aside from, obviously, American lives, blood, sweat, and tears? All right. I'm out of time. I got my one-word answer out of Brigham. No. No. And then I'm full of energy today, Brigham. A little hyperactive. Some listeners said they're going to send me Xanax to calm me down. But I'm brimming with excitement about this topic because we had a big, big, exciting win here in the Ninth Circuit. So we have to celebrate when we can. Talking with Brigham McCown. As I said, Brigham used to be the top guy over at what we call the PHMSA, the Pipelines and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration, former naval aviator, which is very sexy, very sexy. Brigham, thanks so much for coming on. You're one of my favorite guests of all time.
Thanks, Jackie. Appreciate it.
We'll see you, Brigham. You're listening to Jackie Daly. We'll take a break. You're listening to The Jackie Daly Show. Find me at JackieDaly.com. That's Jackie with no E. Daily like everyday.com. Or on Twitter or Facebook and Instagram. So I just spoke with Brigham McCown, my friend who is the former administrator over at the Pipelines and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration. And he wrote a great piece in The Hill and is titled Slow and Steady Wins the Climate Race. Photo at the front of President Biden and the Saudi prince fist bumping, which makes me nauseous. And you know it's going to be a good article when, in all caps, red letters, it says this at the very beginning, the views expressed by contributors are their own and not the view of The Hill. Okay, what he says, that essentially climate activists are pushing too quickly for this transition in energy with unintended consequences, the biggest one being that the United States embraces fossil fuel producers with spotty human rights and environmental records like Iran, Saudi Arabia, and Venezuela. Yes, yes, yes. Embracing fossil fuel producers. You heard right. He's talking about the Biden administration. The only fossil fuel producers they don't embrace are the ones right here at home. But if you are a dictatorship or a theocracy that won't enforce environmental standards on your one cash cow, which is oil and gas, hydrocarbons, you're fine. You're fine. And he points out, this is Brigham McCown again, points out renewable energy in the U.S. has increased by 90% over the past two decades. That sounds amazing, doesn't it? Even so, these energy alternatives are responsible for producing a mere 4% of transportation fuel. 4%. That's where we are. 90% increase over two decades, 4% of transportation fuels. Did you see, by the way, my shout out in the Dallas Morning News this week? It's kind of funny. It's an article about my husband working on creating more parks in Texas, right? State parks, which I support heartily. Okay, and then it just mentions, Deason is married to Jackie over at the Jackie Daly Show at The Blaze. And it said something like, I'm well known for slashing attacks on renewable energy. Slashing attacks. I've never had the word slashing applied to me before. And I'll admit, I kind of relished it. That was pretty cool. Normally, I don't like cameo appearances in stories about other people over which I have no control. But look, it's not that I'm anti anything. I actually don't want to be known for being an attacker or a critic, because anyone can do that. I really want to be known for proposing solutions that can build something, that can be something. It's the slashing is just one part of a much bigger narrative, which is that we have to do the smartest things. The things that keep us at the top geopolitically. Wind and solar cannot do that. As I said when talking to Brigham, we can't win a world war on renewable energy. We just can't, unless you consider fossil fuels and nuclear renewable. By the way, some people do. It is made fossil fuels over time, a long time. And nuclear, we can produce and make more, make more, make more. But when I say renewable or alternative, yes, I'm talking about wind and solar primarily. I'm not anti. I just find them to be incredibly inferior to traditional energy. And that is why, you know, it's not like wind energy is new, right? Windmills have been around for hundreds of years. We used to power our ships with wind exclusively. It's a very primitive form of energy. Bottom line, if you don't have fossil fuels, you're not a world power. Forget about it. Which is why, after the First World War, and then again after the Second, one thing that you saw were the world powers rushing to carve up the Middle East. Let's just be serious. In North Africa. Why? Why did they do that? Why was that so important? Why was Hitler rushing to Baku, Azerbaijan? Because it was the oldest and one of the biggest oil fields on Earth. And whoever has that has the edge. Period. Okay. So all of that, again, back to what Brigham had to say. He says you need only look to Europe to see that renewables are simply not ready to pick up the tab when oil and gas are cut off. Okay. Metaphor. Biden extends one hand to green energy in the U.S. while he grasps oil with the other hand from dictators and despots abroad. After all, he has to keep the lights on somehow, right? So this is what's happening. This is the true picture. Frankly, because of the European war, probably, in 2022, America surpassed Qatar and Australia to become the world's largest exporter of liquefied natural gas, or LNG, and 74% of what we exported went to Europe. So, in Brigham's words, America is storming the beaches of Europe yet again, but this time with natural gas, would be absolutely accurate. And I asked Brigham, can any country win a world war on wind and solar? Answer, no. And this is why our adversaries are pushing for it. It's all about a disconnect between ideology and reality. It's easy to embrace an artificial timeline for a carbon neutral world, but creating the technology and the physical infrastructure necessary to drive that change is much harder, he points out. And by the way, it doesn't exist right now. I talked about this in past shows, and I think that Mark Mills at the Manhattan Institute is actually the best at explaining this and putting this into plain language. Literally, the mining required would be about 10 times what we have right now for rare earth minerals. You know, we're talking about cobalt, lithium, whatever, to produce all these renewable sources and electric vehicles. We would have to scale up mining 10 times. It's not very green, and right now it doesn't even exist. This technology doesn't even exist. Because despite all the advances, what are your problems? Number one, renewables are intermittent, they're not scalable, and even if somehow you could overcome those problems, the U.S. power grid is not capable of handling an all-electric society. Probably there is no power grid in any country that is capable of handling an all-electric society. Those are inconvenient truths. It requires environmentalists who are honest to acknowledge that hydrocarbons, that's oil, gas, coal, will be required for much of the century. But you will not get that admission, I don't think. And as Brigham says it, moving forward like lemmings could cause catastrophic consequences for American energy security and prosperity. But as I said, let's talk about solutions. I don't want to be an attacker. The solution, according to Brigham, is to keep pressing for innovation while acknowledging that domestic energy production is an American strength. Since the 70s, every president, Democrat and Republican, does not matter, has promised U.S. energy independence. And it never comes to pass. It never comes to pass. Before the fracking revolution, you could see why. It was very difficult. And even when we fracked and became the number one oil producer, which our competitors had to put a stop to, of course, by any means possible, even then, we were exporting most of our oil because the refineries, many of which are controlled by the Saudis, Venezuelans, and others in this country, yes, they accept this heavy, sour crude, which is conveniently what Saudi Arabia and Venezuela produce, because that's where we have been taking our oil for so long, not the light, sweet crude that America produces, primarily. And people will pretend like it's impossible to build new refineries. No, it's not. Your U.S. House just passed a bill to try to make that easier so we can use our own instead of just exporting it. All right, got to go to break. You're listening to The Jackie Daly Show. You're listening to The Jackie Daly Show, and I'm continuing my commentary on Brigham McCown's work. He is the former administrator at the Pipelines and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration. I was just scratching the surface of his op-ed in The Hill. It's called Slow and Steady Wins the Climate Race. And picking up where I left off in the last segment, he says that the irony of today's America is the hostility to oil and gas in the U.S. by our government doesn't seem to extend to countries without democracy or environmental protection. So based on government numbers, the Biden administration has reversed a 10-year-long trend of decreasing crude oil imports from OPEC. Again, reversed a 10-year trend. Less and less and less from OPEC. Now it's going up, up, up. Under his tenure, get ready for this, monthly, every month, imported barrels from OPEC countries have risen from 14 million to 40 million. Again, during the Biden administration, which is not even done, we went from monthly barrels of 14 million from OPEC to 40 million. So instead of fueling freedom, we're fueling polluting theocracies and dictatorships with cash. After urging the Congress to ban Russian oil and gas, Biden goes all over the world in search of oil elsewhere. First, he eased sanctions on the Venezuelan regime. You remember that. And then starts fist bumping Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, pleading for him, which is embarrassing, to increase OPEC production. And as Brigham says, it's very safe to assume that the name Jamal Khashoggi did not come up in those talks. I bet it didn't. So after having gutted successfully investment in U.S. oil and gas with ESG policies and literally greater than 80 hostile policies that were identified by the Republican National or no, it was the Republican Study Committee in Congress, and then the Western Energy Alliance, I believe it was, out of Colorado. 80 policies to kill U.S. oil and gas. He then tries to, fix the problem by tapping or raiding the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, which is supposed to be used for emergencies. And by emergency, I don't mean tanking poll numbers. I mean real emergencies. So this has been the path. The administration told everyone we were ready to unload fossil fuels for renewable energy. And then at the very same time, went on a world tour, a world begging tour to get more from OPEC and others. And we have purchased Russian oil and gas. They wouldn't be able to fuel their war without it. The ridiculous plans to put caps on the price of Russian oil and gas has been laughable. As I told you, apparently now they're selling it to third parties, other countries that resell it for a higher price. How's that? There's always a way around this. They will find a way. But I want to return to Brigham's point earlier about banning natural gas. I found that my friend Robert Bryce, who has his own Substack column, which you should check out, has written extensively on this and has done some of the best work that I've seen, uncovering the big money behind these natural gas bans. Do you notice, a campaign to ban something as basic and essential as natural gas, it just comes out of nowhere. Nowhere. And then suddenly, all the think tanks are talking about it, the news outlets, it's all over Twitter, all at once. And suddenly, natural gas is deadly. It's going to kill you. It's going to give your children asthma. On and on. Where is this coming from? Well, I thought that this was an amazing piece by Robert. It's called The Billionaires Behind the Gas Bans. And specifically, he has photographs of Steve Jobs' widow, Laureen, Michael Bloomberg, John Doerr, and Jeff Bezos. He says the hypocrisy of the billionaires who are funding anti-hydrocarbon campaigns, that means oil, gas, coal, including bans on gas stoves, he says they're more about class than climate change. I'm not sure that I agree with that. I'm really not sure that I agree with that. I don't see this as like class warfare of the rich against the poorer, although I do believe that they think people who aren't themselves, especially the majority, are unnecessary hosts or parasitic onto the earth as a host, rather. I think they see people as parasitic. So maybe he's right about that. But his point, I think, is that, look, here's the real agenda. You can pollute as much as you want, as long as you're rich enough to pay for the carbon offsets. If you're rich enough, there is no cost to you for the green agenda, just for everyone else. That is all. If you're the average middle-class guy, you should expect to see your lifestyle suffer tremendously. So Robert focuses in on something called the Climate Imperative Foundation, which is the newest and richest, by far, anti-fossil fuel group that you've never heard of. You've never heard of them. Why? According to GuideStar, which is where all the nonprofits report their numbers, this group, Climate Imperative Foundation, took in $221 million in its first year of operation, which tells you that a bunch of rich people came along and formed it as a proxy for themselves. This is not a group that started out small, organically, grassroots, and had to earn its reputation, earn its way to its trust with its donors. No, the donors created it, not the other way around. Okay, though they're less than a year old, they take in more cash than the Sierra Club, which calls itself the nation's largest and most influential grassroots environmental organization. And Sierra Club has $180 million a year going in there. the Rocky Mountain Institute, also big on this natural gas ban, ticking 130 million. But the emergence of the climate imperative, the big one, has received virtually no attention from legacy media outlets, which by itself is curious. They, you know, believe me, they had the money for a PR campaign. Why aren't they doing one? Because they don't want you to pay attention to what's going on. Okay, first, it has this push to electrify everything. Electrify everything, which is what banning the use of natural gas in homes and businesses is all about. It's part of a years-long, huge campaign bankrolled by some of the richest people. Okay, what happens when you electrify everything? Number one, you greatly reduce the diversity of the fuels fueling your country. So for example, you know, diversity is always smart. You take a country like Iran or Venezuela, they mandate flex fuel vehicles that run on gasoline taken from oil or natural gas. Why do they do that? So in case one is ever sanctioned, they can run their transportation sector on the other. It's very smart. You should always want as many options as possible, especially those options in which you're rich, right? So very smart policy by these OPEC countries. We're doing the opposite for some reason. Third, banning natural gas in homes and businesses could actually be worse for the climate. Burning gas, get ready for this. This is so important. Burning natural gas directly allows consumers to use about 90% of the energy contained in that fuel. Using gas indirectly by converting it to electricity first, and then using that to pump, you know, power your heat pump, your stove, whatever, wastes more than half of the energy in the fuel. Did you hear that? If you use natural gas directly, you actually use 90% of the energy in the fuel. If you convert it to electricity first, you lose more than half of the energy in the fuel. How do we know this? Well, it's science, but I'm going to credit one man, Glenn Duquette, who wrote a book, Blue Oasis No More, Why We're Not Going to Beat Global Warming and What We Need to Do About It. He's only a PhD in nuclear engineer from Argonne National Lab. Don't worry. Not like he's smart or anything. This is a real expert. All right, I can see I'm out of time. I'll come back to this. You're listening to The Jackie Daly Show.